Welcome to the Mind Dive podcast, brought to you by the Menninger Clinic, a national leader in mental health care. We're your hosts, Dr. Bob Boland
and Dr. Carrie Harrell. Twice monthly, we dive into mental health topics that fascinate us as clinical professionals, and we explore those unexpected dilemmas that arise while treating patients. Join us for all of this, plus the latest research and perspectives from the minds of distinguished colleagues near and far. Let's dive in.
Lucky to have Dr. Shore on today. Dr. Jay Shore, he is the Executive Director of the Brain and Behavior Innovation Center at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus. He is Vice Chair for Innovations and a professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Family Medicine and the School of Public Health Centers for American Indian and Alaskan Native Health. Dr. Shore is Chief Medical Officer for Access Care Services and a Population Scientist at the Department of Veterans Affairs Office of Rural Health, Rural Veterans Resource Center.
The Veterans Rural Health Resource Center, Salt Lake City.
His career has focused on leveraging innovations to improve access and quality of care and mental health. He currently is participating in multiple projects, which include development, implementation, assessment of programs in community, native, rural, and military settings. Dr. Shore has consulted for tribal, state, and federal agencies and served on planning and or grant review committees for several federal agencies, including Department of Defense, Indian Health Services, and the National Institutes of Health. Though it doesn't say it exactly in all that, he's an expert on telehealth, and that's why we're talking with him today.
I'm thinking, just even from your bio, Dr. Shore, there's so much we could talk with you about.
So many interesting things, but
actually makes sense to me, especially given perhaps your work with rural veterans and like rural health, that then you would be an advocate and somebody interested in telepsychiatry. That makes so much sense to me, the connection there.
Right. So welcome.
Welcome. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So for starters, like I said, I first got to know you because of, you know, your expertise in that. And for a while, you've been talking about how we could be doing telepsychiatry mm-hmm. better. But can you tell us a little bit about your career and like how you got interested in telepsychiatry?
Well, and just as you said, it was my initial career interest and focus was working with American Indian Alaska Native populations. And so my major career mentor when I started video conferencing, this was in the late 1990s, early 2000s, wasn't a standard part of the practice of psychiatry. And so it was really beginning some initial programs and pilots in more of the early days of video conferencing. And what drew me to it was the ability to use the technology to increase access and quality of care. I think some people are drawn into tech and mental health. They get drawn in from the tech side of it. They're very interested in the different technologies and how it could be applied. I came at it from the patient side. I'm still, compared to many of my colleagues in informatics and technology, sort of a Luddite in terms of my ability to run and use the latest tech. But it was really working with the American Indian Alaska Native populations, both in the community, but then through the VA and veterans, where I got my initial experience and then expanded to other technologies and broader foci, including the delivery of health services.
I'm not remembering exactly which podcast right now, but we've had someone on, and I want to say it was early on, where we talked about how per individual in the United States, the amount of psychiatrists, like psychiatrist individual ratio is like out of control. Like there's so few psychiatrists per individual who even just might need support. And then I think you add, you know, geography in there. Like a lot of psychiatrists are in populated areas.
What we do, even though the numbers sometimes look good, they're clumped in major urban areas.
I don't even think it looks good though. And then you add the clumping. Yeah. And then again, to think about people in rural areas and just access to care. And yeah, it makes so much sense to me that like this would be something important, and I'm so grateful. And it seems like the VA has been such a part of like pushing and trying to help kind of solve this problem. And one thing on my mine and what we're some of what we were talking about too, is that the pandemic clearly also then changed the landscape of this. Like, this is already happening as a field. And I think it was actually probably, if I had to guess, a little more controversial pre-pandemic. People would be like, no, we need in-person services.
I would go as far as say, if we were doing this podcast, say, 5-8 years ago, we'd have to spend a fair amount of time you explaining what telepsychiatry is. And I suspect we don't have to do that now.
No.
I think everybody knows, like,
what telehealth in general.
Like, exactly. Is. Like, what it means to sort of communicate with a patient via video.
And so I wonder if you can speak a little bit to, even in your career, like what you've noticed has shifted and what factors are at work. And like, if this is becoming really like the preference for most people. And yeah, curious what you've seen in your time working in telepsychiatry.
Yeah, no, I was very fortunate in my career over the last few decades to start a focus in telehealth, starting with video conferencing, expanding other technologies. And as my career matured, I watched the field mature. So there's certainly sort of a noticeable pre- and post-pandemic time. So pre-pandemic, the field started really, really began to take off in the 90s when the computer revolution happened and it became easier to do video conferencing. But we started in the field basically seeing if we could replicate in the 90s and the 2000s what we were doing in person over video conferencing. So it was like, wow, can we do an intake? Wow, can we prescribe a med? And they'd do a bunch of studies and they'd be like, wow, we can. And, you know, the patient doesn't spontaneously combust over video and it'll be okay.
Exactly.
But there was a lot of issues to work out, safety protocols, coordination, adaption of clinical styles. But then with the advent of cheaper and more accessible video conferencing tools, web video conferencing, the field continued to evolve. So it wasn't just what we were replicating, what we were doing in person, but we began to look at reconfiguring how we approach people, how we put services together. So the technology began to be used to sort of invent new types of processes and services. So I think the best example for that is modern day integrated care services, which nowadays are a combination of complex teams, of different providers, different patients, patient panels. They use EHRs, video conferencing, email, you know, all these technologies blended together, how a big integrated care service worked, which just would not be possible. And in the 2000s, we just weren't practicing integrated care that way. There's many examples like that. So my career early on was just convincing people that telepsychiatry was safe.
Yeah.
And then just safe to
do. What were they worried? Like, what were they worried about it being not safe?
And people are always worried about how you manage emergencies, right? Safety issues, acute lethality, you know, how you work with a patient remotely who's in distress, sort of forgetting the parallel half century of lessons from phone management. And right, we have been doing this and the two fields didn't really come together. But, you know, I mean, clearly you can manage patients effectively over distance and crisis. And there's an argument that doing it over video conferencing gives you added data to do better management, and you can do it in their home. So there's lots of arguments, but particularly systems and individual providers new to this, that was always their first, you know, concern that you needed to address. And then after safety and feasibility, we had to sort of prove effectiveness. Could you get the same outcomes? And clearly the literature demonstrates that it's equally effective doing in-person versus virtual treatment, with a huge caveat. You have to modify your clinical style. You have to adapt what you're doing. You have to do it very thoughtfully. I don't believe you get the same outcomes if you don't do that. Because you can, just like you can do bad in-person care, you can do bad remote and virtual care. And we've seen that. And so before the pandemic, it was this advocacy to get people to adapt, to begin to think of using it and integrate it into their systems. the highest functioning systems with telehealth before the pandemic, maybe 10 to 20% of their visits would be virtual, maybe a very high functioning, forward thinking, virtual type of system, right? And then the pandemic hit and everything became virtual. And now as we emerge, many systems are still more virtual than in person. So the pandemic, what I was trying to do, what I accomplished 10% of and it took me 20 years, the pandemic did in one day.
Yeah. Well, it is amazing, right, to reflect on that. Like, right, because I know, like, in my own institution at the time, there's this kind of sense of, like, well, first of all, we didn't do any telepsych. And the sense was, like, well, you know, yeah, we could. We're aware of how to. But, you know, why would we give, like, second-tier treatment when we can do it in person and be, like, the best place? And, like, and there are all these arguments back and forth about the quality of it and stuff. And you're right. And all of a sudden, within, like, a week, we're, like, everything had to change.
Well, and I remember
there was no choice.
I was a fellow. I was a postdoc in 2020. And we weren't given laptops. The postdocs really didn't need laptops. We had, like, desktops that we would use. And all of a sudden, like, it happened so fast. They were like, well, crap, we need to be able to have our trainees be able to join meetings virtually and all this. And it was just like this total also rush to get enough technology for all of us, which I'm sure we're not lone rangers in that. But I'm interested, especially because I feel conflicted about this, if I'm being honest. I still feel conflicted about this as an attachment specialist sort of person. Is the idea of, like, what gets lost or, like, what happens virtually that can or cannot be replicated, and balancing that. And this is where I'm like, this is a mess, because I don't think there's one right answer. Is balancing that with some is better than nothing. Like, access to care is better than not access to care. And is it, you know, ideally maybe we'd all be in person, but what gets, and maybe that's not true. Okay. So those are my question, to be more clear, is like, what are your thoughts on this, of the balancing of, like, what gets lost virtually and what gets added virtually?
Those are great questions. I think the framing should be a little different.
Frame it for us.
The framing. We're entering an era of what we call hybrid relationships, both in our personal lives and our professional.
Yeah.
And that means we manage relationships through a range of technology. I have a relationship both, let's forget about our personal lives, but with a patient, I have it in person. I have it over video. I have it over email. I have it over a patient portal. I may have it over an app now. And in each of those settings, there are strengths and weaknesses to each of those, including in person. Let me give you an example. When I first started doing this work, I was, and I still do remote work with Alaska Native populations, but, you know, 20 years ago, and I was working with Alaska Native females with trauma, many of them at the hands of domestic violence. And as Bob knows, I'm sort of an outdoor toy. I'm 6'5", I'm loud, I'm male. Mm. So I would meet with these women who had been traumatized for initial intake over video. And at the end of the session, they would say, "Dr. Shore, wow, I was able to share things with you that I've never told anyone else." And at first I was like, yeah, because that's because I'm such a great interviewer. But then I began to ask them why they were able to do that. Yeah. And it turns out I'm probably a mediocre interviewer at best. Bob knows me.
Absolutely not.
But the distance of the distance and sense of space that they had in that initial session with not being in the room. If they were in the room with me, you can tell I talk loud anyways. I'm tall. I'm an outsider. I'm not sure I would have gotten that feeling of safety and comfort that the virtual space created. Yeah. So I'll tell you what, if you give me a traumatized Alaska Native woman, I would probably prefer to do my first visit virtually and probably the first few and then meet with her in person. On the flip side, I've had many patients who are slightly intoxicated, which is a lot harder to tell over video, where in person, I'd be like, "You're intoxicated. We're going to pause because I don't do intoxicated therapy, but let's reschedule." Whereas over video, you can't tell and you don't want to come out and say, "Are you intoxicated?" So you have to beat around the bush and like, "Oh, when was your last drink?" And they're like, "It 30 minutes before I came to see you." And then I'd be like, "Well, we're going to do things different." So potentially intoxicated patients, I want to see in person, right? Am I communicating with an adolescent that I know for therapy via text? Maybe I'm going to get more information in the text format with them, right? So each patient, you have this a range of technologies, you have the diagnosis, you have the timing in the diagnoses, and the challenge to be a really good clinician now is to know the boundaries, strengths, and weaknesses of each of these mediums to communicate when and how to use it to render the best care. So it's, to me, it's never an either or with this.
That makes so much, I think that makes so much sense. I appreciate the examples you gave too, because again, I'm totally tracking, especially with certain patients where the distance of the emotional distance and the ability to titrate that using video, mm-hmm. I think can be so helpful. And again, I think also for other patients that would be not helpful. And yeah, it comes down to the individual. That makes so much sense.
And there's this whole really interesting concept that we haven't explored in psychiatry too, of what is this virtual space? And, you know, examples of what is it? One example is this idea of virtual disinhibition, which we've seen if you've treated patients in their home or their car. And in some ways, you get more information because they're not in your office. Their guard maybe down a little and they reveal more. And it's subtle. We see virtual disinhibition in our systems all the time, right? With email, where people put things in email and then you're like, oh my gosh, that went out to 500 people.
Yeah.
And they didn't really intend that. But the median, right, isn't matched. But we see that on video conferencing. We see that you can also create inhibition, right? Maybe the video conferencing is distance and you're not going to open up. But particularly when you're going into patients' home, I think it facilitates that. And then you have to manage that boundary. And we all probably have stories of colleagues, experiences ourselves where, you know, you have to set limits. You're like, Mr. Smith, you really need to get out of your bathrobe, out of the bed. I will see you, but you need to be at your kitchen table. This is not appropriate. You know, Mrs. Jones, you've got some activity going in the background. There's some family members. Can we get to a private room? Because what we're talking about may not be appropriate, right? And so we all sort of have those types of examples.
Do you let patients smoke nicotine or vape in sessions with you virtually? And I'm sure that's not a one fits all answer, but no, I've struggled with, because I work mostly with college students. I have struggled with this one. I'm like, it feels different than drinking.
So what do you do in that situation?
Honestly, for the most part, with most of my patients where this has happened, I just notice it. I'm like, hey, I'm noticing, like, when we're talking about this, you tend to hit your vape like a lot more. I wonder if you're feeling stressed. Like, that.
So you use it as information.
Yeah, I just like reflect it back to them. Yeah. And I haven't, unlike where I have caught my patients drinking alcohol during virtual sessions. And I've said, hey, that's not something that I'm comfortable with. This is not for therapy. I've not asked people not to smoke nicotine. I would feel different if it was weed, but I've not asked people just stop because we're in session. I've just noticed it.
So I think there's two issues. One, you bring up a more general issue. One of the things I worry about is that from the provider standpoint, so at the end of the day, if someone came into your office and drank or smoked or disrobed, you set limits and control the office.
Right.
I think providers in general, I counsel, like, at the end of the day, you're in charge of the session and you need to set the limits and boundaries. And I think on the provider side, in the virtual space, people may be a little more hesitant to be as directive as they need to be. So I think it's always good to be directive. Now, with nicotine, you know, in the olden days, and Bob, we both know Pat O'Neill, who was a mentor of mine, who, you know, I don't want to over-disclose, but...
Yeah, esteemed psychiatrist, yeah.
Esteemed psychiatrist, and he doesn't use nicotine now, but when, like, many, many years ago, I was with him and the patients would smoke, like, staff used to smoke on the ward. So nicotine, I think each substance has sort of a cultural...
I used to see training films of like psychotherapy where like you could barely see the patient and the doctor because like it was so full of smoke. Yeah.
So, and I'm also a harm reductionist and everything's grist for the mill. So again, is that vaping going to impair the session? Is it not? But I do think commenting on it, and then as a general healthcare provider, even if you come across more luxury, first of all, sort of noting it and noting the relationship, like if they're getting stressed, That's helpful feedback. And then finding the appropriate time to then use that as a window for education on nicotine cessation. But it may not be appropriate if just like they're really keen to something heavy and they take a smoke and all of a sudden you're like, well, do you know the nicotine's bad for you? And
yeah, nicotine's actually really bad for your health.
That's right. I'm going to share a picture of your lungs here.
But it could be the next session before you start. Hey, remember last session you were smoking? Look, I'm a healthcare provider. Obviously, you can smoke and such. I'm not going to tell you not to. But two things. One, you know, we all know it's addictive and it's problematic, but it also seems to be part of your sort of managing your distress. Maybe we should talk about that in your relationship with substance. And if you want to think about reducing or quitting, I'm here to talk about that. And I think you open the door. I don't think you say we're going to have to talk about this as making part of your treatment, but are there other resources you need? So that's how I would sort of, I would do it in the moment like you're doing, but then looking for the window for an intervention later in terms of the substance use.
You are clearly such an incredibly thoughtful provider. I'm just, struck by that. I have a funny meme to share for a second. One of my favorite, I saw this around the holidays, and the meme said, doing teletherapy over the holidays from your childhood bedroom has very reporting live from the scene energy. and it, obviously it's a joke, but it does, again, I do think something else you said that struck me is just this idea of like, we do get something interesting and important for many patients when they're doing therapy from their home or like we're in their space. Like we get these
interesting and important, but sometimes it seems intrusive.
I bet we feel different about that.
Interesting. I don't know. In the sense that stuff that you might see that they wouldn't have naturally showed you.
That's true.
So it's all about boundary management. I had the blur. I'm working from home because of the storm, right? If people, as a therapist, I never say this, but I even do this with my colleagues. Whatever you show on Zoom, right? I don't know if you guys do this when you're looking, but I'm always fascinated by people's background, right?
Of course. There's no, like you're... It seems rude, like if you're in like a Zoom meeting, but it's
So you're looking. There's sort of a dog cage. There's sort of a stack of things.
There's this looking like toys or something up there. I can't see what that is. Yeah,
chips, right?
Those chips. Yeah, right. So, sadly, the audience can't see any of this, but it's a very neat office. I'll give you that.
Well, but here's a little bit of a messiness there, right? So this is all grist. I figure it's grist for the mill, and that someone. Even if they're not aware, if they're going to sort of share that you're, especially as a treatment provider, you're not judging, you're just sort of noting the information. Where does the patient feel it's appropriate to meet with a provider in their house? Is it neat? What does the room look like? Is there stuff going on in the background? You can, it's almost like, you know, just sort of not judging, but just sort of assessing and generating some hypotheses you may discuss, you may never discuss. I mean, like, your guys' background is completely psychoanalytical. It's a white wall. I see, you know, a curtain and you have a microphone. It's like boring, right? The other thing you can do with backgrounds, which I've thought about, right, is tailor. So if I was working with, you know, someone from the West, this is one of my favorite virtual backgrounds, right? You may feel really more comfortable if you come from a rural community. I'm showing this background.
You're showing a background of lovely. Where is that?
This is Wyoming. This is the plains. This is a mountain in Wyoming and elk. Like, this may not do anything to you. You guys may be like, what? But if I was working with a rural veteran from this area, this may be a lot better than that blurred background, right? We've never done studies. But I suspect, right, as we know, body language and visual
study option
80% of our communication. I would love to see a study on what is Zoom backgrounds. How do they impact?
Someone needs to pick that up. Dr. Schwartz just dropped an incredible opportunity for a research study.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I could be narcissistic and like.
That's a great picture.
Yeah, he's showing
right,
a drawing of himself now. Okay,
right. Or I could show you this, different phasing of my beard, right?
We're getting different background options.
Right. Mostly of him.
Yeah. Which is, or right? Like, this is another nice professional background. Now, this is very different than the
one. Another outdoorsy. You like the outdoorsy scenes.
I do, but
it's like a ranch or something.
That one was, the sun was out. It was spring. This is winter. See the ice? You've got the moon, the moonrise, right? This is a different feel. Maybe this is if we're, I mean, I don't know. This could be a little spooky or a little bit more intimate, right? Less open, right? Or maybe it's more cozy. How do you?
No. So honestly, I can't tell you why, but I am so averse to Zoom backgrounds. I never use them. I had to use one recently because I was presenting at a conference where they asked all of us to use the same background, and they had our name and our credentials on it. And I just was like, I hate that, because quite frankly, usually I very well curate the back of any, like both in my home and then in my office here, but my background's very well curated to be seen on Zoom. So I'm like, I don't want to be on.
I just blur it. I just do the blur. Yeah.
This does feel like a good place though to go next, or to kind of keep thinking about, which is, and we're talking about this already, but like, I'm sure, you know, our listeners who are kind of broad swaths of mental health providers, over the last few years, I think many people are sort of trying to navigate this before the research has caught up, of like, what is best practices and what are some of the best tips and hints for working?
Early on, you said there's a right way and a wrong way to do like telepsych. So it's probably time to talk about the right way. Like, what advice do you have, or what's your approach when you set something up for telepsych?
It is so complicated. But first, like, my concern with COVID is a best practices. So me and a colleague at some point, we don't do this anymore, but we would do sort of a consulting through our academic work and help programs set up telehealth. So what we do is we go in, and first we would help them sort of write out their protocols and procedures, emergencies, drop calls. We then come and educate the staff about the research and the background and get them up to date on the rules and regulations, so they had working knowledge. We know there's things you have to have working knowledge, licensure, prescriptions, all of that. So you've got that. And then we would do a separate training on processes. My experience early on, I ran one of the first dedicated resident training for telepsych. This was like in the early 2000s. I had this clinic with three residents, each in a room, and I just wander back and forth between their sessions, taking notes, giving them feedback, supervision. My observation is it would take a minimum of 20 hours. It would take anywhere from once a week clinic from 6 to 12 weeks before I would say someone became basic competency in telehealth.
Wow.
So to me, it was 20 to 60 hours, depending on the individual. And most people think, oh, and again, maybe it's because we Zoom and video conference, but using it clinically. And so I do worry that we don't do enough training in this. Just watching how they use the technology, interacted with patients. So anyways, when we were doing these consultations, we would do a half day. And we would give people scripts and scenarios. You're the provider, you're the patient. And then we wouldn't let them share with each other. And we put them in rooms like down the hall. And then we go in and we pull out their technology. We cut their bandwidth. And like we give them a suicidal patient and we cut off the video. And then like, I'm like, well, what do I do? I'm like, well, what is your protocol? What did we talk? What is the, right? So they're practicing. So to me, that's really, you get some practice, best times, and probably the first 20 hours getting some feedback, which people never get in supervision. So when COVID happened, I know that we instituted telehealth overnight.
Yes.
And people were doing it and just assuming. I think my framing today, as you see, is pretty decent for telehealth.
Yep.
Now you can, if I wanted to sort of get a little more intimate, see, I can become closer.
It's kind of close.
Right. But Bob, if we're talking about some very serious things that you need to change.
Right up into the camera with that. Yeah,
you got to cut that up. Or let's say you're feeling a little timid. I'm meeting you for the first time. A little bit more sense of distance, right? So I have colleagues who you're like.
The head.
Yeah,
so now we're like, seeing just his head.
Yeah. You're like, like basic competency. And this is their 200th Zoom. And I'm like, what are they doing with patients? Right. And so there are sort of skills, knowing who's in the room, how to talk to a patient, that idea of not empowering patients, but when you have to, laying out the ground rules, like the first session where you do like a where you do a true consent, like they understand what the emergency, the boundaries are over telehealth, how to contact each other, that they're comfortable, you know, sort of the basic things. And I think, unfortunately, as modern telehealth gets integrated into our system, our clinics are patient after patient, you're just booming through, you're not really paying attention to processes, you're not given that time and space. So I do worry, that's why I said it's really easy to do bad telehealth. And I hate to say this, but a lot of people say, well, it can't be done, or it can't be done with that patient. And there are a few patients where really it's probably not appropriate, or you need to be in person. But I've had a lot of patients who had initial bad experiences, and I realized that. And so I approach them differently, right? I do think professional disclosure with patients over telehealth, it can be a little bit more helpful, because you're trying to bridge the distance. Like, so, you know, like today I talked to you guys about my weather, and, you know, I could, you know, show my background that it's snowing out. How, you know, weather is such a great and safe topic, but what you're really talking about is, here's where I'm at, here's where you're at. You're trying to bridge and make that connection. And I think, and this can be true in person too, when you're moving too fast and you forget about, first, you have to have the connection to do the work, and you have to prioritize that. So what are you doing to make the connection with the patient, setting the stage for the environment and thinking that through? Now, there's some patients I can move really fast. I had a clinic yesterday remotely out of state, and geez, I only had 10 minutes, but I know this patient. It's like the fifth time I checked in. I'm like, how's your sleep? And he's in the rhythm, and we're just shooting, because I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry, we need to do a quick check-in. But I've got that rapport and that relationship, and we just had to get some work done, right? Versus the first time I saw him, I took some extra time and worked to establish that base. So I think there's a lot more nuance and sophistication in training and approaching telehealth than we've really addressed as a field. I'm trying to get the basic information out there right now still, like through the APA's website and toolkit, like state licensure and boundaries. The things we're talking about is sort of next level telehealth that many providers don't think about.
It's such a it's such a good point, though, that this is a field and there's so much to it. And yet nearly the whole field just got pushed into
Most people had no training.
And like, just we went with it. And doing some of the back work of like, let's finesse this and let's do this well and right. And
here's a practical question I always wonder about. How do you manage eye contact? Like right now, when I look at you, you look like you're looking more or less at me. It's because of where you're standing in relation to the camera. Right. Though I noticed when you got closer, I could see the difference more. And, you know, you were right. At that point, you're not looking at me. So it has to do with sort of your angle to the camera and things like
that. It does. And that's a fault. Like, this is like, we could solve this problem in an instant if Apple wanted to invest in I mean, the technology is already there to probably align our eye contact. There's
I'm amazed they haven't embedded a camera right into the screen.
That'll come. And what they have is, what we do know is, more than a 7% off gaze angle people will notice. So again, I think also we all sort of just accept, even our patients, the limitations of video conferencing. So you can get away with a bit more, right? And you'll watch your colleagues on these Zoom calls, right? Some of them are really good now multitasking. Other people can't. They're not good at it, right? And so the, you know, there's that whole thing. I think there's also some space in forgiveness. I mean, in the early days, the literature was all about eye contact. And you're right, body language, that's another thing in addition to background, right? Do these changes impact the session? And if they do, do they change the outcome? And maybe they impact the session, they don't change the outcome, or maybe they really change the outcome, particularly in the therapy realm, and we just don't know. We just don't know how, because we don't have the data. You know, there's anecdotal and suspicion, but, you know, treating people based on your gut is a favorite thing to do in medicine, but it's not as effective for your outcomes, right?
Do you tell patients how to position the camera? on their end?
I will be directive. I know some patients, but if a patient's like cut off, I'll just be like, I can't see you. Do you mind just sort of adjusting a little bit? Oh, great. I can see. Love to see your smiling face. That's so much better.
A lot of my college students, when they're getting, I'm holding my phone up to show this, but when they're getting sort of a void in or we're talking about something, all of a sudden their phone's facing the ceiling. And I'm like, could we keep your phone facing you? I would love to keep seeing you. Because they'll like all of a sudden they're drifting. I'm getting just like a quarter of their face. They're looking at the ceiling. And I'm like, come on, let me keep looking at you. You've given me a lot to think about. I think this is an area where I've struggled in that. I would much prefer to see my people in person. And there's been times, especially working with my college student folks, where like it's made sense to make that transition and like for the sake of the therapeutic relationship and their progress. And yeah, I'm just appreciating the work and the language you've put to some of this. It's been really helpful.
Yeah. So my whole career has been virtual, not just with patients, but I've worked for DOD and the VA with teams around the country. And even today, because it's snowing, even when I go to campus, I have more virtual than in-person meetings. That being said, I've had some in-person practice. If we had the technology, like the Star Trek beam, where I could beam to a patient, you know, being in person has its advantages, but obviously I can see more patients in more diverse locations and move more efficiently. That's the benefit. But I do understand that in-person thing. And Bob, you may have been part of these conversations, but at the college, someone brought up like the fact that some of the residents in COVID have never got training in person. I think this is a huge thing for the field. What's the appropriate dose of in-person and virtual-based training? We don't know, but I firmly believe people need both. Even if you're going to do a full telepsychiatry career, which many of our colleagues now do, you know, I think I was lucky to have a blend of both early on in my career. And even though I've done more telepsych than in person, I did have some healthy in-person experiences. So I think if all you, and moving forward, like you said, one of the future issues is both patients and providers may not have as much experience with in-person in the future.
Yep.
And we don't know what that.
Well, a whole generation was trained, you know, a whole group was trained, not just psychiatrists, all doctors with very limited in-person contact. Yeah. Right. Yeah. What do you see for the future? What are you looking for? What technologies or other things are you looking forward to?
So I think AI is really interesting. I mean, there's so many. And now, you know, I have a couple different leadership roles, but one of them is director of this innovation center. So video conferencing right now, we use it as an adjunct to other technologies, apps, AI. So I think the most exciting and interesting and risky thing is sort of where AI takes us, both AI and video conferencing. So for video conferencing, you could see, I think we will get there, whether this is 2 years or 10 years to get there, because, you know, it always takes longer. But let's fast forward to some point in the future. We're having this conversation. I'm doing couples therapy with both of you. So I have this platform. And right now, you may know that this platform has an auto dictation summary function. So, that summary function is going to generate the full medical note for me that I just reviewed. And they're already working on this in many systems.
I can't wait.
So I think documentation will change and go away. And there'll be other things with AI and documentation, which we can't. I'm just talking about video conferencing.
Sure.
I think it is very possible that I will have a video overlay I can click on that will be analyzing your micro expressions in your face and giving me potential, and I've heard people proposing this for a decade now, but I think technology is getting there. Like Bob is slightly sardonic right now, and you know,
what do you think Carrie's doing? She shakes her head no.
I don't like that too much for me.
I don't need a microcomputer.
She's getting burned out with your sardonic nature, Bob. You know.
And
it might even, like, some people are claiming through biomarkers, voice. And I've seen this, but it hasn't been proven to me, but voice detection of depression or stress. So not only video, but the audio could be giving me sort of a printout at the bottom of the screen of things to look for. And it could be pulling from your medical record and saying, here's some information from the medical record. So I've got like you guys won't see it as patients, but I have a heads up like dashboard, like a fighter pilot. You know how fighter pilots now, like there's a, I don't know if you read, there's like a, I think it's like a $600,000 helmet that the F-32 pilots have that's completely mapped into them. Yeah. They don't ever get to put it on. They get to use test versions till they're flying the plane. Tracks their eyes. They can.
Yeah. So we're going to get those too, do you think? Like we could have those for our patients?
I think that the heads-up display in a future Zoom would do our medical, would give us information and do our charting for us that could give give us readouts about audio and video biomarkers that are present at minimum. And I see, again, how quickly the technology is there that we could put together a prototype if Elon Musk decides that instead of going to Mars.
We could do this now.
It's too spooky. Yeah. I don't like it. It's very Black Mirror to me.
All right, well, sign me up. That sounds like fantastic.
Well, like I said, so it's more the system integration and then the testing of effectiveness and does it work.
Yep.
But it's beyond conceptualization. And in my work, I've been hearing these concepts for a decade, but I think the technology is there to put them together.
Well, Dr. Shore, it's been really exciting talking with
you. Yeah, so much to think about.
Yeah.
Well, you've been listening to Dr. Jay Shore talk to us about telepsychiatry and his career and the advancements. And gosh, we so appreciate you being here with us, Dr. Shore.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we've been your hosts. I'm Dr. Carrie Harrell.
Dr. Bob Bowen.
And thanks for diving in.
The Mind Dive podcast is presented by the Menninger Clinic. If you're curious about the professional experiences of mental health clinicians, make sure to subscribe wherever you listen.
For more episodes like this, visit www.menningerclinic.org.
To submit a topic for discussion, send us an email at podcast@menninger.edu.